Welcome back to the Bark Side of the Moon podcast.
Hello, how are you?
Sure, I'm great. How's things with you?
I am doing fine, thank you very much. Glad to be here again.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
As always.
Promised.
I just dropped my phone on the dog, the sleeping
dog's
face.
Oh, great. That's a good start.
Sorry, Decker.
Oh, Jesus.
You can edit that out. I was like moving it. And I kind of, it's plugged in and I was kind of like trying to sort out all the wires because I've like the computer and the thing and then I just dropped it on his head. I'm so sorry.
That's a more whimsical start to the podcast.
Yeah.
And I'm glad because it's a heavier subject matter than maybe we have discussed in more recent times. Behavioral euthanasia.
Mm-hmm.
I know we talked about it a few times about doing it and then just kind of put it off for a little while. But I think it's time to talk about it.
Okay.
And obviously
we've worked our way up to it.
Yeah. Well, obviously like euthanasia itself is always a difficult enough thing to discuss. So how do we go about discussing it today then?
Yeah, so I think definitely any time we're discussing anything related to pet loss, it's going to be really, really tricky. And then discussing anything in relation to euthanasia or putting our dogs or animals to sleep is harder again.
Yeah, yeah.
So discussing behavioural euthanasia is probably the hardest one because it's generally surrounded by pretty heavy stigma and controversy. So when we talk about behavioural euthanasia in ANIED, we have done quite a bit of continuing education resources on it. We have I've done a webinar for like people outside of our professionals as well. So we kind of have some, you know, a disclaimer, some ground rules before we start going into this. And we want to be very clear that, you know, anything we talk about, we're going to discuss it compassionately.
Oh, yeah.
Right. And compassion means, you know, to suffer together or, you know, feeling empathy for others, you know, being aware of others suffering. So we're really careful when we cover this topic so that we're mindful of others suffering. And if a person has had to euthanize their dog in relation to that dog's behavior, or if they're considering behavioral euthanasia, or if it's something that might be in the very back of their head due to their dog's behavior, well, I am absolutely thinking of those people when we have this discussion.
Yeah.
And even if we don't agree on something, we can always start with compassionate and respectful dialogue, because that's the only way forward, right? There's no there's no point just talking to argue. We have to actually be talking to listen to one another and consider one another's points of view, while also making sure that, you know, and certainly from my point of view, I have a professional responsibility to be very, very careful about how this is discussed and about how we discuss pet owners who are in the unenviable position to have to consider or even remotely think about this. I wouldn't wish it on anybody.
No.
And unfortunately, I get to work with a lot of these people, and maybe not unfortunately, maybe actually fortunately, because as we discuss this, we will be talking about euthanasia from a point of view of alleviating suffering, and behavioural euthanasia should absolutely be considered that, because behavioural suffering is no less impactful than physical suffering, and possibly more so for various reasons. So if we're talking about behavioural euthanasia, which generally relates to euthanizing a dog relating to concerns about their behavior, then we are very much talking about this in the alleviation of suffering category.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're very careful to make sure that we're mindful of that going into this discussion.
Yeah.
And compassion is our goal here.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so
that's a heavy start, right?
No, it's a great, it's a really lovely start. It's right, though. So, so what is behavioral euthanasia then for somebody who doesn't, who's never really heard it described in that way?
Okay, So I guess people are familiar with what euthanasia is in respect to animals. I know the discussion of euthanasia for people with terminal illness is, you know, a pretty hot topic right now. Mm. And we see that discussed a little bit about that in various contexts. Mm. But euthanasia is often colloquially referred to as putting the dog or the animal to sleep, right? Yeah. I guess that's what people would think about that. And generally speaking, and certainly historically, euthanizing a dog relating to some physical disorder or perhaps an aging related, you know, deteriorating condition has often been better accepted.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not saying at all that it's easier. Because as we said, if we're talking about losing our pets, and this, of course, is the thing, we live a relatively long life. So we're probably going to be in a position where we have to suffer through maybe several losses. Right. And we might, you know, have experienced the loss of many pets throughout our life, you know, from childhood all the way through to, you know, old age.
Yeah.
So generally, and I would say historically more so, this idea of euthanizing a dog to, again, alleviate their suffering relating to some physical disorder, maybe a terminal condition like cancer, for example, has certainly been more acceptable. I would have said that in more recent years, maybe the last decade or two decades, that the emergence of so-called no-kill movements, a lot of veterinary advancements, pet insurance to pay for really complex treatments, and even a very much building hospice movement for pets is something that has meant that euthanasia is often not considered as acceptable as maybe it once was. But when we take this into the realm of discussing behavioral euthanasia, as in talking about euthanizing a dog because we're concerned or their behavior presents concerns, I would say that that's probably the least accepted out there by people, you know, directly related to the guardian, the individual guardian of this dog, or within the animal care professions. Within the industries and among society themselves. What do you think? How do you feel people view that or view behavioural euthanasia? Do you think they view it differently?
Yeah, I think so. I think definitely with, well, a lot of rescue dogs, and I think you have some data on your own personal experience and stuff with helping dogs, even in the last year. But I think with rescue dogs, well, because when I worked in that area, people felt pressure for sure when they were taking on these dogs that they were going to fix them and help them and this was it. And certainly with some of those dogs, you can never tell somebody to do that or advise them really to do it. They have to arrive at it themselves. But things that I would have heard, I would be thinking, that dog has not got a nice quality of life. And I would like to think that if my dog was showing things like that I would be thinking about it quicker than that person or whatever at the time. But then I think it is really, really tough. I think the pressure from other people outside as well and the guilt of even thinking it before it is like huge. And you have more experience obviously with all of this because you would have gone through it with many clients, I'm sure. But I'd love maybe later to talk about that with them, you know, the guilt that people feel before, during and then afterwards. Like I know personally people that suffered with it usually afterwards and what they went through when they were even arriving at that decision. So, it's horrific. Nobody would arrive at that decision lightly, quickly or easily. So I definitely think of that. Yeah, I think people would be more like, oh, well, you know, they're old or, oh, well, you know, the poor thing was really, really sick and it was best to help them on their way. But I think then they're thinking about the dog's behavior Mm-hmm. And you put them to sleep for that. Mm-hmm. Or could you not have, oh, you maybe you could have helped them with that, or somebody must have been able to help you.
Yeah.
And then what about this? And maybe, you know, moving them or all of those kind of things. And I know we're going to go into that in more detail when people, you know, we can do almost like an example, right? You know, you're a person, you have this type of dog, what do you do kind of thing. But yeah, I think so too. I think it's definitely the last thing people would think of. They would try everything else before going there. And not just the people, but I think, yeah, people that they're asking advice from as well, sometimes too.
I mean, I think many of the people I work with where this becomes part of the conversation, we have a lot of time and we do a lot of talking through, and we might have done quite a lot of work with the dog prior and, you know, all of that kind of stuff. But for some people, there isn't that, and behavioural euthanasia becomes a more urgent thing, perhaps in the case where, you know, there's legal involvement, for example.
Oh, yeah.
And then that time just isn't there, that ability, that the control and the decision making might be taken out of your hands, or your options are severely limited, for example. So that can happen too. And I think that's going to be that's going to have so many extra layers of trauma involved in that. Mm. So, you know, it's to really ensure that listeners understand that when we're talking about behavioural euthanasia, and I can only talk about what I do within my professional experience, we are talking about agonising discussions. We are not talking about frivolous things.
No.
We are not going to trivialise this and say, oh yeah, this is just, you know, the dog is pulling on lead or something like that. That's just not, you know, these are not the things that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And the other thing to understand is that we're not just talking about behaviours that we refer to as aggressive responding, or behaviours that present safety concerns for humans.
Mm.
We're not just talking about those. We're very much talking about quality of life, and what that means and how we recognise that. And I would say that one of the things that the average population of pet owners is not great at doing is recognising concerns about quality of life in dogs.
Yeah.
And there's lots of reasons for that. First of all, there's cultural reasons, because we're blinded into believing that dogs just like us because we exist, and they love us because they have a life like ours. And I don't think that's the case at all. No. But also because it's really difficult to be objective about your own dogs. So, you know, that can be really difficult to do. Mm. So, I can't expect everybody to be always good at that, because that's just not going to be possible, even for me and for you, Graham, too. It's not always possible. And we do need outside help. But certainly there is a gap between what dogs need and what most dogs are provided with. And I feel that gap is growing, and that's growing because of those kind of cultural leanings and because of our masking to the potential suffering of dogs. And certainly, you know, when we're talking about behavioural euthanasia, it is usually when we're talking about something that severely is affecting that dog's quality of life now, or will affect, or will continue to affect that dog's quality of life.
That's on the way too.
Yeah. And the thing to understand is that if a dog is having to use aggressive responding to control what happens to them in their day-to-day life, they are not experiencing, they are probably not experiencing a good standard of welfare.
No.
So these are stress-related behaviours. And if we're doing them, it is because we're experiencing some level of at least acute stress, but probably chronic stress. And that is akin to experiencing chronic pain. It can cause similar responses in the body. We know that stress can lead to pain. So stress is actually painful. And people will often find it easier to understand that level of suffering when we equate it to physical suffering. And one of the things that I would always kind of stand up for is first of all, is suffering is suffering. And behavioural suffering, if the animal is not experiencing a good quality of life because the ability to meet their behavioural needs is inhibited, well, then that animal is suffering no differently than an animal with a terminal condition that's experiencing chronic pain, or going to experience chronic pain, or is going to experience such a suppression to their regular day-to-day life that it's, you know, it's not a life worth living. you know, well then that to me is no different. And I will always, you know, kind of stand up for that.
Yeah.
It's the, you know, it's the thing that we're that I talk about the most, that suffering is suffering. And you know, we need to make sure that every day is them having a good day. And one of the things that I'll often say is, you know, about a dog in a particular situation is I might say, if this dog was to die naturally at the end of any given day, would that dog have had a worthy final day on earth?
Yeah.
Would their day have been a good day? Mm. And the reason I emphasize this so much is because dogs become their life. Now, that comes from a resource I read about cat behavior. And to this day, I have not been able to find it. To reference it, and it drives me insane.
If you can't find it.
Yeah, well, I have no idea where it came from. And it was obviously about cats, but it's, you know, it's translatable. Yeah. And I really loved that it talked about that dogs, you know, they were talking about cats, but I'm talking about dogs. But dogs become their life. They become their pain. They become their stress. They become their boredom, their frustration, their loneliness, their isolation. To them, to that individual dog, there is only quality of life now. They cannot be convinced that, oh, in 3 weeks' time or in 6 weeks' time or in 8 weeks' time, things will be better.
No.
And for that to be okay. And for that animal to go, all right, then I just have to suck it up until,
get through it.
You know, until I get to then. That's not something that's available to them.
Yeah.
Their quality of life is now, basically. Mm. What's happening to them now? And I want to ask, you know, what life would this dog choose? And there's this fantastic paper in a related field that looked at kind of compassion and compassionate teaching. Mm. And one of the questions the main author asks is, what would that dog be doing? Or what, they're not talking about dogs, they're talking about people. I am talking about dogs.
Yeah. And all animals.
And what would they be doing if they weren't suffering?
Yeah.
And I like to think of that. So if this dog wasn't suffering and they're, behaviors of concern or the dog's behavior in general, they're only concerned relative to our concerns, right? Mm. So the dog's behavior is information. So if I look at behavior and go, okay, these are behaviors where they might be maladaptive or they might be inappropriate or unacceptable or unsafe or, you know, whatever way we want to categorize them. But that behavior is telling us that dog's experiences. So if those behaviors are indicating that this dog is suffering because we're not able to meet their needs, what would that dog be doing if that wasn't happening? Mm. And can we make that happen? And if the resources don't exist to make that happen, well, then that animal's quality of life is suffering. And that's the metric that we use. It's the decision-making tree that we are using. Mm. So we're assessing all of those levels of quality of life, right? Yeah. And we're asking, you know, what would that dog be doing if they weren't doing these things? Mm. And what's required to make that happen? And what's the reality of making that happen? Can we keep that dog safe to make that happen? Can we get that happening as quickly as possible? Can we remove the barriers to get this happening so that we're able to focus on flourishing? And that's really what we need to be doing. Because the thing I say all the time, and I say this about every single dog that I meet, is that dogs are here for a good time and not for a long time. And I truly, truly believe that because to the dog, to the individual dog, it's not about quantity of life. So it's not about living this big, long life, which is something that's for us culturally, that is so significant that we have long lives. Right.
I
and
know.
We're relative to dogs. We live a long time relative to tortoises. We don't live a long time.
No.
Relative to the history of evolution, it's an absolute dot in time, right? So it's all relative in that respect. But the animal doesn't care about quantity of life. That dog doesn't care that they're going to live till they're 16 or whatever is a good long age for that particular dog. The quality of life is what we should be recognizing as having the greatest ethical significance, really, in relation to all of this. So that's what I'm interested in making sure the quality of life is maximized rather than quantity of life, which is just not as much of a concern. It still may be relevant to welfare, but it's not the individual dog's concern. they want to have good quality of life today. What is their life like today? And if it were to all end today, unexpectedly and completely naturally, would they have had a good last day? Is that day representative of good quality of life? And that's incredibly important. And I have an aging dog, so that becomes even more, or no, not even aging, we're all aging, aren't we? I have an old dog. So like you, I have an old dog.
Yeah.
And that's something that becomes even more relevant when I start to think about, God, if, you know, if he died in his sleep today, did he have a really good day today? And I'm like, I'm working really hard to make sure that that day is a really good day for him. And, you know, and one of the things I think that we love about dogs and that draws us to us, to us two dogs, is they kind of live like that, don't they? They kind of live like, this could be my last my last opportunity to eat. Like, that's certainly Decker's mantra. He's like, well, I need to eat it now because I could be dead in 5 seconds.
So at least if I eat it now, I'm having it, right? They do. They help keep, I think it's a big thing with people with animals. Yeah. They do keep you present and out of your head, especially if you're working with one, training them or whatever. I think it's for a lot of people, I know from other people that I've worked with anyway, you know, they would say that they it's their favorite time when they're like working with a dog or whatever animal. Because it's, you've got to be present, especially if it's a dog that's exhibiting different things. You've got to be on all the time and you can't be thinking about anything else other than what's going on right now. So that's almost like some sort of meditation for us.
You would go that way. I might not, but you might.
But it's just the way it's been described to me. It's like, oh yeah, I'm just, you know, not thinking of anything else, so my head is clear, kind of thing. But yeah, and I know when you're saying, is this a really good day for dogs? And I suppose everybody has their different opinions on what a good day for a dog would be.
Yeah, I think so. I think that there's probably some level, it's quite difficult, isn't it? But when we assess quality of life, one of the measures we do use is subjective experiences. And it has to be subjective experiences from the subject's point of view. So how do we know that dogs are having a good time? How do we know that they're getting to do behaviors that they that are really naturally reinforcing for them? And I think that's what we should be looking at. So I like to think of, you know, instead of, you know, measuring the amount of time you were out with your dog, or you're measuring the number of steps that you took, or, you know, because I know that's a metric that people use.
Everybody's obsessed with it.
You know, those sorts of things. Dogs don't care about that stuff. So what would be, you know, how many sniffs did you sniff? How many different substrates did you walk on or jump over? What did you explore? How many holes did you stick your head in? How much rolling did you do? So I'm just thinking of my dog. How many balls did you chase? How much food did you eat? How many puddles did you splash in? And those are metrics where I know that if he's done those things, and the reason I know that those things are reinforcing behaviors is because he does them again and again. Right. And he will seek them out. He works to access those things, as in he does behavior to access those things. And this, so these are things that I work really hard to make sure that he has access to every single day. And, you know, so I look at what are the other things then that that individual dog might want to do. He wants to spend time with his human. He probably wants to rest close to them. He probably wants to eat a lot of completely inappropriate food, which like ourselves.
Or things that aren't food.
Oh, well, that too. Absolutely. So, you know, so I start to go, well, what is the dog doing? That's what tells us what behavioral needs they have. They're already doing those behaviors, or they're already trying to acquire outlets or access outlets for those behaviors. And so then we have to say, well, how can we make sure that's happening? And if those behaviors are problematic, they're usually probably problematic for us, that gives us information about what that dog needs to do or needs outlets for. So the easiest one to illustrate is dogs that chew what we call destructively. From the dog's point of view, they're just doing what they do. So, and people will say, oh God, we have to remove all the things that they might chew so that they can't chew. And you're going, no, you've got this wrong. The dog was telling you this the wrong way around. You're looking at this like you're a human. And that's understandable because you are a human. But sometimes when we consider dog behavior, we have to be a bit more dogs. So we have to think about it from a dog's point of view. So chewing is completely normal, natural and necessary behavior. So that's an Ian Dunbar statement that I have, or that I have stolen unashamedly. actually. he brought that.
He nailed it. Yeah.
Yeah. No, he definitely did. No, we have to credit Ian with a lot of things, and that's one of them. And so that's normal, natural, and necessary behavior for dogs to chew. So instead of me depriving that dog of chewing, I'm going to provide so much stuff for chewing that the destructive or problematic chewing isn't relevant, right? Mm-hmm. So he doesn't need to chew other things because I'm going to provide him with things. So many things to chew, varied things of all shapes and sizes, and all his chewing desires and wishes would come true, basically. So that's the view of that, I suppose. So when we talk about quality of life, we can measure that. We can say, this is the amount of time this dog engages in those behaviours. And these are the barriers that are preventing this dog from engaging in those behaviors. And these are the measures we must take to remove or reduce those barriers so that the dog can engage in those behaviors. And if it's not possible to do that safely or just realistically, because unfortunately, the bottom line is what resources are available.
Yeah.
Realistically, right? The reality of it, not pie in the sky, not in 6 months' time, not in 6 weeks' time, because the dog cares about this today. And so what are the resources that we must have in order for this dog to carry out those behaviours? And if they're realistically not available, or we realistically cannot provide access for this dog safely and in acceptable and appropriate ways, well, then that dog's quality of life may be suffering. And to me, that's not good enough.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's my bottom line is the dog can't be in pain and they can't have a poor quality of life.
No.
That's my bottom line. Today.
Yeah.
Not in 6 weeks' time. Today.
Yeah.
Because that's what the dog cares about, right? So,
so
those are my bottom line. Your mileage might differ and that's absolutely fine.
Yeah.
But we do have some data on quality of life in animals. And we do need to consult that because, as we've discussed, it's difficult to be objective about this.
Yeah.
So people have probably heard of like the five freedoms, for example, right? Mm. And that was, born out of really severe so-called factory farming, kind of really a discovery of this. This wasn't well known. And it came about because post-World War II, there was a population boom and there was this pressure to produce enough food. And as soon as we up production, animal welfare is going to decrease.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, of course, exactly what happened and continues to happen and will continue to happen. Let me just say, because as the population continues to grow and resources continue to dwindle. So the five freedoms were a really important framework at that time, but we've kind of outgrown them. And the reason we've outgrown them is because the five freedoms talk about negative welfare. So they talk about, freedom from hunger, freedom from thirst, freedom from, pain or whatever all of the things are. And, the problem is that the absence of these negative welfare states doesn't necessarily mean that the animals are experiencing a positive welfare state, right? So just because you're not hungry, right, doesn't mean that you're actually experiencing good food welfare, right?
No.
And we can really easily see that when we have higher rates of overweight and obese pets than we do the human population, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's, contributing to lots and lots of difficulties, including shortening of health span. So, meaning that the animals are not living as long or as healthy for as long.
Mm.
And that's been demonstrated in dogs too. Mm-hmm. So that is a framework. It's certainly in the bottom back of our head. But really, we've moved on. And probably the model that we use more now is we talk about this domains model of animal welfare, Meller's domains. And that talks about both the absence of positive welfare indicators, the presence of negative welfare indicators, but also the presence of positive welfare indicators.
Mm-hmm.
So what should we be looking for if we're saying that the animal is experiencing a good standard of welfare? So what's the animal's behavior? What's the animal's body? What's the animal's responses telling us about their experience? And that's that entire central focus on that behavior. The animal's behavior is information.
Mm-hmm.
It's the least invasive way for us to collect data about their experiences is to observe their behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And they will tell us what their experience is. And so when we talk with people whose dogs are showing behaviours of concern, that's what we're talking about. We're not just talking about that behaviour and how it impacts the person. And that is also important. The person's well-being is important as well.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But we're also talking about how does this behaviour function for this animal? What information is this dog giving us about their experience? And again, so that we can measure where we are now and where we need to get to, and what are all of the barriers on that journey? So what do we need in order to do that? So quality of life is very much the central focus when we talk about behavioural euthanasia, as it is if we're talking about euthanasia for physical disorder reasons too, right? You know, so we're talking about, well, you know, what is this dog's experience today? Are they having more good days than bad? Are they able to do the basic things that they need to do? And, you know, are they eating? Are they drinking? Are they able to get up, move away from their bed, toilet? Are they able to sleep comfortably? Basic physical parameters for telling us that an individual is having an okay time, right? But when we talk about behavioural euthanasia, we're talking about more than that, because we're talking about behavioural quality of life as well, and what we want to be able to do with that. So that's our central focus. And for anybody who has any doubts about whether we take the decision-making process seriously, we take it very seriously, incredibly so. And I think it's important for people to understand that we're not making any decisions. So when I'm speaking to pet owners, these clients, I'm not making any decisions for them. I am just, this is a counselling process, and all I'm doing is opening that space up for them to explore what they, you know, can think about as they learn more about their dog's behavior and the implications of their dog's behavior and the impacts that their dog's behavior is having on their dog, on them, the potential impacts, and what's required to get to this, to a point where everything is healthier. Then people will often start to use language that suggests they are thinking about how this dog is going to continue as part of their family.
Yeah.
And that has not been considered out of convenience, which is sometimes referred to, you know, in various places. It's not being considered out of, you know, because it's the easy way out. It is absolutely not, you know. So we provide guidance without influence. So we're just there to say, this is what's going on. To get this healthier, this is what you need to do. These are your options. These are the implications of those options. So that's what we're doing. So I wouldn't want anybody to think that when you come and have a discussion about your dog's behaviour with us, that we're going to strong arm you in to saying something. Because one of the things that we will have, particularly where dogs have bitten a person, or where they've bitten, particularly where they've bitten children, is one of the fears that they will have is, oh, I thought you were going to tell me that I would have to put your dog down. I put my dog down, and I'm the first thing I would always say is, I'm never going to tell you have to do anything. You know, about any of this. I provide you with the information, I provide you with the guidance and the support, and the rest is up to you, really, you know. So, but there can be other things that are informing euthanasia decisions. So there can be legal requirements. There can also be professional guidelines. So vets will have professional guidelines about discussing euthanasia. There are pretty complex ethical frameworks that we have to consider. And but like I say, my central focus are going to be the welfare needs, the quality of life of this dog, and the well-being of their people and those around them. So those are the considerations.
Definitely. Okay, so will we do, say, let's do an example.
Okay.
Right, so you're a person.
I am a person.
With you're a dog. Right. That may be showing these behaviours of concern. And so before, I don't want to say it, but obviously you might be thinking about it, or you might not even be, but before making any decision or anything like that. So what should you be considering?
If you're concerned about your dog's behaviour?
Yeah.
Okay. So the first thing,
like when we're in relation to this. So I would imagine if you're sitting there and you've tried, you know, maybe you've tried a few things and things are getting worse. People maybe have said to you, oh, you know, whether it might be a professional or family people. Member, friend, yes, other people yes. have said, yeah. it won't be the first time you're thinking it, for mm-hmm. example. It'll be something yeah. that, and it's coming up. So what, before making any decision, uh-huh. what should this person be considering?
So providing you have the time to do that and there isn't this excessive well, pressure, yeah, yeah there's mm-hmm. like legal pressure or whatever, the dog is yeah, being yeah. seized or something. So the first thing that I would always say is that we talk to the dog's vet. I mean, that's always going to be mm-hmm. the first recommendation that we have. And while you're pursuing a veterinary conversation, you're also going to come and just talk to somebody like us. And you don't have to hire us or anything like that. I mean, you know, you can come and talk to us anyway, but that would be, you know, really, really the very first thing. And what I would do from a professional responsibility point of view is I will, if you haven't already, I will absolutely refer you back to your dog's vet, and we will talk mm-hmm. about that from a point of view that behavior always has a biological basis. Mm-hmm. And usually with behaviors of concern, there is some brain involvement mm-hmm. because the way that neurons in the brain communicate with one another impacts behavior. And so we might be more likely to associate those changes at brain level with behaviors that we would call aggressive responding or fearful behaviors, phobic behaviors, panic related behaviors, things like that. That's often what we'll see. And they can often have a physical basis, as in injury or pain can have, you know, impacts on behavior, but also longer term exposure to stress related kind of triggers. So things that cause these or lead to these stress related responses will have a damaging effect on the body as well. So there's this kind of bi-directional relationship, right? So, you know, so it works both ways. But also we want to make sure that we can rule out any physical conditions that could be contributing to behavior or that these behaviors are clinical signs of. So behavioral health is health, and behavior can be considered clinical signs of lots of physical disorders and diseases. We just need to actually know what we're looking for or recognize it or observe it and make sure that we can tie those kind of connections together. So certainly this is why we would have a collaborative relationship with your vet and want to work with your vet team so that we can kind of go through all of these things, you know. So we're hitting both sides of the aisle, basically, you know. So we're hitting the physical stuff and we're hitting the behavioral stuff. What I would normally recommend is that you would come and you would have a remote session with me. And the reason for that is I'm going to be really slow to give out any specific advice when I haven't got a history on that dog. It's incredibly irresponsible for somebody to turn around after a short conversation about that dog and say, you must do this or you must not do this, or this dog should be PTS'd or whatever the, you know, the conclusion is. That's absolutely irresponsible. And it's not something that I would ever, ever do, because I will want to have a discussion with you about your dog's history. So going back in time to the first time you knew about your dog and working our way forward. And I always kind of laugh and joke and say to people, you know what, we're going to be talking about the COVID years. That's like when time lost all meaning. So it can be really difficult. It's been an absolute curse trying to build histories over that period, because you're kind of going, yeah, it was sometime during COVID. It was definitely not before COVID. It was definitely not after COVID. It was sometime during COVID. And of course, that could be you know, anywhere in 2 years, you know. That terrible kind of lost black hole of time. And what we do with that is we build a timeline. And a timeline is really useful for me, because what that allows me to see is this dog's changes in behavior due to something that's, you know, developmentally relevant. So maybe it's normal for dogs of certain behavioral developmental periods to show behaviors like this, or for these changes to happen. Or and we can also tie in changes with behavior with certain environmental things or physical things that were going on. And that might lead us down a path, you know, kind of, you know, recommending specific treatments, recommending specific courses of action. So that stuff is really useful. And while we're doing that, while we're going through that, I'm making sure that that person has a really good understanding about why their dog might be doing these behaviors. How do these behaviors function for them? How are they tying in with the dog's normal behavioral development? What are the things that we're doing, so that the person is gaining an even deeper understanding of their dog's behavior.
Yeah.
And from that, that will allow us together to consider, well, what are the next steps? What are the possible options? And generally speaking, the options, there's five kind of main options, right? And the vast majority of the time, we continue with the first one. So the first option is that we collaborate on building a behaviour support program that we participate in fully and we work through together. Mm-hmm. That's the first option. And that is invariably what we're going to be doing, mm-hmm. right? With the vast majority of people that I will meet with.
Yeah.
The second option is that we put in place lifelong management. And mm-hmm. that means that we don't necessarily do any specific sort of behavior work, mm-hmm. but instead we just prevent putting that dog into a situation
yeah.
like this again. And that might be present for lifelong. That mm-hmm. wouldn't necessarily be my favorite way of going about things, because I do feel that, you know, management can fail. It doesn't have to, but it can fail. And then if we've been, you know, if we've been limiting that dog's access to the world, that can, you know, mean that their response is stronger to that situation if they're put back into it accidentally again. Yeah. But also lifelong management requires a certain level of deprivation. So we have to ask, can we maintain quality of life if we're managing this dog's exposure to something?
Mm.
And this can often become a thing that we're talking a lot about when we have dogs in homes with children. And there is some level of management that is always required between dogs and children.
Of course, yeah.
There just is. And, you know, I'm at a point now where I'm very much on the fence about continuing to do child dog cases, because this becomes really, really difficult for families to put in place while also maintaining the animal's quality of life and maintaining the family's well-being with their pet. So it becomes a thing of going, well, if we have to, for example, one of my rules would be that if small children are active on the floor, the dog is not present.
Yeah.
And usually by the time I'm working with people, there has been at least one incident, if not more. And so it becomes even more crucial. And it's kind of urgent. And we often don't have the time to prepare this dog over a period of time. And that might mean that that dog now has to be confined away for certain stints of time. And we have to look at, well, is that okay to that dog? Can we make sure that their needs are still met in another way? And it's really difficult if you have children. Obviously, they have to be the focus, and obviously they are going to be the parents' priority. And that's absolutely acceptable. And I would expect that. So then we have to ask, well, what realistic resources are available to make sure that this dog's needs are continuing to be met? So whereas that has to be in place for everybody's safety. And it, in some cases, has to be urgently in place for everybody's safety, so that things don't get worse or that children don't get hurt. And, you know, and that means that the dog's welfare will definitely suffer. So that might have to be in place. But then we have to look at, well, if I'm managing this, so I'm preventing your participation in certain things or your access to certain things, how can I meet those needs that you are kind of being blocked from you? And so that's a really important question. So management is actually a two-sided coin. There's the prevention bit, but there's actually also the other bit. We have to compensate for management. So I would generally not be a huge fan of that as a standalone strategy. So I would usually have that with the first one in place, right? So that we're doing the full behaviour support program. Plus we have management in those certain areas that we might need them to be in to make sure everybody's safe. So those are the first two options, and I usually want to have those together. The third option that people will come to, and particularly if they start to consider, well, you know what, the reality is that I'm not able to provide for this dog's needs safely. So the first option that they'll often consider then at that point is they'll consider rehoming their dog. And again, I'm not going to say yes, and I'm going to say this is the option. These are the implications of this option. So at the moment, as I'm sure you're aware, Graham, as well, and you're experiencing this, there is a crisis in terms of unwanted dogs in this country. We haven't seen this level of dogs in rescue for a really long time. Rehoming has slowed considerably. There are lots of reasons and contributors to this that are beyond the scope of what we're talking about tonight, maybe another podcast. But certainly rehoming the dog is not the easy option, if you like, in terms of your guilt, because we need to understand what are the implications for the welfare of that dog in that situation. How long are they going to be in limbo for? Are they going to have to spend extended periods of time in a kennel environment or in an environment that maybe isn't, you know, ideal or doesn't specifically suit their individual needs, for example. And remember, it's the dog's quality of life today, now, that matters to them. So if we are just going to, you know, put that dog into a rehoming situation or a rescue situation just to keep them alive, but not necessarily be able to ensure their quality of life now, today and every day, well, then that might have implications for that dog's welfare and may not be an appropriate option for this individual dog, particularly if we're talking about dogs that are already exhibiting behaviours of concern. What makes everybody else think that there's somebody else out there for that dog? In some cases, there absolutely is. Sometimes dogs do better by just changing them to another home, just to a new environment or to better environmental conditions. So that absolutely does happen. But I will guarantee you that love is not enough. Loving that dog is not enough to help that individual dog, as much as I wish it was. Because if it was, we wouldn't need to be having this conversation. Behavioral euthanasia wouldn't exist, wouldn't be a thing. So that is an absolute option, but we then need to consider the implications for that individual dog, not dogs and just dogs in general, but that individual dog. So the fourth option then is we could relinquish the dog. So the dog could go back to where they came from or be relinquished, as in surrendered to a local authority pound. And there are similar implications for that. Now, relinquishing the dog, that dog might go back to a previous home. They might go back to a breeder, they might go back to a rescue, or they could be surrendered to a local authority pound. And there are specific animal welfare implications to all of those possible options. Again, similar to the notion of rehoming the dog, it sounds better, but may not actually be better from a quality of life point of view. And then the fifth option we might discuss then is behavioural euthanasia. So all three of those options where the dog is moved from their current family will require a grieving process for the family. It just will. It results from their point of view, it's the same result. The dog is gone from that home. And that's going to have implications for all family members, everybody who knew that dog, including other dogs or animals present in that home as well. So, you know, regardless, right? So for them, there is you know, a somewhat similar result. But behavioural euthanasia is probably going to stand out differently. And it stands out differently because, well, there's definitely a finality to it. Once we do it, we can't undo it. It is done and that is it. There's no going back. It also provides closure for the family, the humans, as in they know exactly where the dog has gone to and what has happened to them. And, you know, they've seen that happen and that's the end result. Whereas if they move the dog on in some other way, they might not have access to that. But behavioural euthanasia ends that life for that dog. So if that dog is not experiencing a good quality of life, that suffering is over. And again, I'm not promoting any one or other of these options. There will be different considerations in each specific individual case. But I do want to make sure that, you know, I am, I guess, clarifying that euthanasia isn't the worst thing to happen to that dog necessarily. Right. And certainly I don't believe that. I wish this was a thing where we didn't, you know, where resources weren't an issue and there were unlimited resources to provide wonderful lives to every single dog that comes along. And regardless of their needs, we had an immediate solution to meeting those needs. But unfortunately, that is not the case, unsurprisingly. And I will be very honest, I am not a fan of just putting dogs into rescue and taking whatever length of time. I mean, I don't celebrate when I see those posts on social media where a dog has been living in rescue, whether that's in limbo or in a kennel environment for 100 days or 300 days or 500 days or sometimes years. I don't celebrate those. I don't know that that's humane, and I don't know that that's conducive to meeting that animal's welfare. And, you know, that would be my feeling about that. Mm. And is it the case every time? No, 100% it's not. Couldn't be, because there are no absolutes in behaviour. It doesn't exist. Yeah. But I do often ask, are we really rescuing these dogs?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They're almost, those dogs made into like celebrities and sending you, I don't know, cards and stuff like that when you're almost, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, mm-hmm. some places would use that as a way for you to donate and really pulls at people's heartstrings then, you know, but then that dog is just like, why?
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. We agree on that for sure. Yeah.
Well, when I think of like the complexities of meeting the needs of dogs for many modern guardians. So, for example, you know, and particularly this is illustrated by COVID, which we mentioned there, and has possibly contributed to the current dog rescue crisis we're in right now. Mm. This kind of thing of getting a dog and then work when you work full time or you're out of the house for long periods of time. Mm. And yes, there are some individual dogs who will happily lie there for hours a day, maybe older dogs or whatever, that might happily lie there for hours a day, and their behaviour will not indicate that they're, you know, suffering or lacking anything. But the truth of the matter is that dogs are social species, and we have selected them to like people more than other dogs.
Yeah.
And then we play this cruel trick. We take them on and then we socially isolate them. We make them completely reliant on humans and then we abandon them. And, you know, that is not something that I feel is conducive to welfare. And I would say that it is a contributor to many cases where we see behaviours of concern, you know. And I think it's important that we start to recognise that dogs, you know, have, you know, really specific behavioural needs that we must meet now, because the further we can find dogs away from their chosen way of living, which would be out and about, getting up to all sorts of mischief and skullduggery, I'm sure, moving around freely at will.
Just being dogs,
right? That the more we can find them from that, the more we prevent their access to that. Because we do, for legal reasons, for safety reasons, for hygiene reasons, for ownership reasons, all sorts of reasons. Then the more we have to work to provide contrived behavioural needs. And that's really difficult to do on a one-on-one basis when you live with that dog in a home environment. So you can imagine it's even more difficult to do if there are multiple dogs, or if it's a kennel environment, or you know, on and on and on we go.
Yeah.
So, you know, so that becomes extra difficult at that point. And meeting their behavioural needs to provide quality of life is the central focus always in this conversation, definitely.
Yeah, I think in the last few years, when you say to people, you know, is there a quiet time for you to walk your dog? No, they're like, no, there's like no quiet time anymore. So it's just loads of dogs. And what about, have you got a place around that's local to you that can be quieter at certain times? Nope.
It doesn't exist anymore.
It's not. And it used to, definitely. Well, yeah, I'd say it used to, like, it was easier.
Yeah.
You know, but now, yeah, I think definitely those years with COVID for sure, and then people that thought they were going to be working from home forever, and then that was suddenly flipped on them, which was unfair on them too. Those people are up now at the quiet times trying to get their poor dogs out walked before they have to go to work and get back. And you know, you'd always see those poor, I'm not saying they're all collies, but you know, you might see a collie that's out really clearly not enjoying that walk, you know, and just like, you know, and then it's that thing. I know I used to hear it a lot years ago with a dog maybe that doesn't enjoy their walks for whatever reason, and the person's like, he's a dog though. Dogs like to walk.
Right. Like, this dog, not so much. What you consider a walk is not enjoyable to this dog.
Yeah. And they're just being marched along or dragged along or whatever it is, just to tick that box. And the dog is like, gets home, and they're like, oh, thank fuck for that. That's over. You know what I mean? But then they're like worrying about the next one coming. It gets worse and worse sometimes over time. But I think it's so much harder, even for dogs that don't really necessarily have behaviors of concern. But I hear it more where people are like, I want to have my dog, you know, to be able to just be themselves, but I can't because there's just too many flipping dogs everywhere now. So I just don't end up going, I don't know, up the mountains or wherever it is that they used to go. They just don't do it. And now them and their dogs are more limited. And yeah, they're trying to recreate those things in their house or garden it's not impossible, but like it's weird. It's just
And I would say, you know, like, what is the value in all of this contrived attempts? Are they as valuable? Are they going to actually provide enrichment? And I think that's a really difficult thing to do and to assess. I think that's really tricky. Yeah, definitely. So it's interesting that you bring up like that COVID conditions has contributed, and certainly I think it's contributed to an explosion in the dog population.
Yeah.
But also it seems that it's also contributing to this current crisis that we're seeing on our side of the work in relation to dealing with dogs showing behaviours of concern, which is the main focus of my client-facing business. And we were discussing this beforehand, and I've published this where I write on the Anied blog. So this isn't secret or anything like that, but 23% of my cases in 2023 ended in behavioural euthanasia. And that is more than I've done in my entire career.
Yeah.
I've never dealt with so many BE cases.
That's huge.
Ever. All the other years combined didn't have as many as I saw last year. And that was very jarring for me. And and I will qualify and say this, that some of those dogs were referred directly to me to have the behavioural euthanasia discussion.
Yeah.
So they were referred by some other professional specifically to have that. So it wasn't, you know, they weren't all just these unique cases that came my way and we ended that way. Yeah. But
although you do get a fair enough.
No. I really tried not for things to go this way. Almost all of those, bar one of those dogs, came home during pandemic conditions.
Wow.
And while to me, the pandemic conditions were would have been kind of great for adding a new dog, because for lots of reasons, because, you know, you weren't having a whole lot of visitors. You were there a lot of the time. There was a lot of opportunities to do a lot of people watching, to do a lot of dog watching. You didn't have to have, you know, in order to so-called socialize. And we've talked about this before. You don't have, your dog doesn't have to have contact with other dogs. So it's really interesting to me that those conditions presented unideal conditions for introducing new dogs, because I would actually think with the right guidance, which clearly wasn't available, which is part of this problem, that this was something that was doable, or maybe more doable than it is now. But that's also telling, you know, that almost all of every one of those dogs came home during that time, during a time of flux, where clearly since those COVID restrictions ended, that can often tie in with the development of, you know, or lead into, you know, behaviours of concern developing, because those earlier conditions weren't right. And then this change in the world, then those dogs just didn't have the skills to prepare for that. Whether those changes were local, like their own owners were going back to work and not being with them, or they were global, as in there was more traffic, or there was more air traffic, or there was more noise, or there was more activity.
There's more life.
So the world became more active, you know, in a different way. So, you know, it's one or the other of those, or somewhere in between. But certainly it seems to have contributed to a particularly terrible outcome as a result.
Would it, like, age wise then, would you say, I suppose you wouldn't have them in front of you, but just
I can look it up if you give me a minute. Get my stats up.
I would just be interested to see, say, the ones that were gotten in when it all happened early, were they better off? Because I know there were many that were gotten not towards the, like, right at the end, or maybe, I'm sure there were dogs gotten throughout the whole thing, but like Like if you had a dog that was going through, I don't know, adolescence or something like that, when then everyone started to leave the house again and all of that kind of stuff, would you say dogs then that were older, when all of that's, would they be better prepared for all those changes then if they had a more
that was
stable...
something that's really interesting. Let me just find, I'm trying to find this right now. I have a spreadsheet of the 2023 stats somewhere. So what was quite interesting was that there were some older dogs, so dogs that had maybe were two or three maybe by the time, you know, by what was it, 20, was it early 2020? That was right, wasn't it? You know, so they were a couple of years old by then. They were more mature. They weren't puppies or very, very young dogs going into this. And they were just as, not just as likely, but they were certainly... there wasn't a distinct difference. I do have this information and it was like right there and I can't find it now. Well, of course, when I actually
need it.
That
was just out of interest. I was just wondering.
Yeah, no, it was interesting because it should have been the other way around. So, and that, you know, seems to be, let me just sort out all these, you know, I do. That just does seem to be something that, you know, should have made sense. But actually, if you think about it, we have other experiences of this. So, for example, if we just take the likes of, you know, just that thing of pet owners going back to work, for example, and those dogs, you know, suddenly being left alone. And maybe they hadn't been, you know, left alone for like 2 years or whatever it was. How long did it go on for? Was it like 2 years, 3 years?
It was around that,
something around there. Yeah, there it is, 2023. I was looking for 2024.
Yeah,
so that's that makes sense. I was going, why can't I find 2024? So I actually did have, out of all of the cases, not just the BE cases, I did count which ones came home during COVID. So I do have that stat somewhere. Yes, so 64% of these dogs that presented last year in relation to behaviours of concern came home during pandemic conditions.
Okay. And they were of varying ages. They weren't all puppies, or they were some of them
right,
were
exactly.
older dogs.
So some of them would have been rehomes, but most of them were, you know, around 3 years of age now, right? So most of those dogs, but some of them weren't, and some of them were, came home before the pandemic as well. But it certainly shows that having come home during that time, at whatever age you were, it didn't matter what age you were, coming home at that time, 64% of them, that shows that that's a likely correlatory factor in the development of behaviours of concern, which we now see now, you know, as in we now see the behaviour being of sufficient concern at this stage in 2023 for the warranting the pet owner to seek guidance, basically. So, so the, you know, most of the dogs I will see for in relation to behaviours of concern are 3 years and up.
Okay.
And most of the dogs will have been showing that behaviour for at least a year before that.
Yeah, I'd say.
And that kind of ties in with some of the statistics that we have about euthanasia. And one really interesting study from the last few years, looking at euthanasia rates across dogs in general, just from veterinary clinical records and things like that. And one of the interesting stats from that is that, first of all, that dogs that show behaviours of concern rarely die of natural causes. And one of the most common causes of euthanasia in dogs up to the age of three relates to behaviour. And that's really important for us to understand, that behaviour, the dog's behaviour, is absolutely critical in whether that dog gets to live or not, and whether they're euthanized or not. And you know, so at no point are we blaming or shaming anybody, but we do definitely want to emphasize the importance of understanding that behavior is critical to this dog's quality of life and this dog's quantity of life as well, it seems. And it's really, really dangerous for adolescent dogs, or you know, young mature dogs, the dogs that are just maturing at around 3 years of age. It's incredibly, incredibly dangerous for them.
Okay.
Well, depressing. I'm sorry.
No, it's not. It's really interesting. I love it because obviously you're dealing with it yourself personally. Mm-hmm. So this is why it's so interesting to me. And then you have your own stats, but then there are, yeah, you obviously you're always great at referring to the studies as well. So it's always, it's brilliant. Yeah, no, it's really, really good. But yeah, I was talking about it a little bit earlier about, yeah, just because I personally know people who've had to do this before, and yeah, the guilt leading up to it, during it, and then particularly after it, like, I know, just from me dealing with the volunteers, say with our puppies, right?
Yeah,
and this is not, the puppies are not dying, right? Mm-hmm. They're leaving the volunteers, and they're going into the training center for training. Mm-hmm. But we have bereavement training as part of our jobs, right? Yeah. As supervisors, because it is a bereavement for those people.
Uh-huh.
And I think it's one that's maybe taken quite lightly. And I know personally, obviously, doing it nearly 10 years with these amazing volunteers, I've seen it. It's so difficult for them. And the lead up to when the puppy leaves, when the puppy has left, and then all of a sudden having this puppy from the beginning for a whole year, and then having to just go, okay, well then I'm not going to worry about it anymore. It's impossible. And they feel guilt themselves, in almost like, you know, oh God, you know, the puppy's gone on to somebody who I don't really know, you know, I'm trying to trust them, but it's very difficult for them. And they, that sometimes, depending on the person, they can really struggle with that, never want to do it again. And they talk about certain pups for years and years and years and years and years and never forget about it. So that's, that puppy is not dead, not passed away or anything like that. But I personally have seen how it affects a lot of people. Really, it's really, really hard. It's really, really hard on those people. And they know exactly what's coming and what they've signed up for and everything like that. But then, so when you're talking about something like this, that's what we were saying, like earlier on, this is something that's never, ever taken lightly by the person to get to that decision ever. And I've personally seen people shamed for it, and it's horrific. It's really, really terrible. Mm-hmm. So with the guilt part of it, is that something, I'm sure, well, you experience it because you're dealing with the people. So do they ever ask you, you know, when they talk about it, what do you recommend to them that they do that might help them with that, I guess?
So I think there's some really important things here. And I guess I'm really privileged, although these are awful discussions and I don't want to be having them, definitely. And it last year has shaken me for sure. But I feel really privileged that people feel that they can discuss this, that I can help them plan for these procedures, I can help them plan for the aftermath. And I think when we make sure that the environment in which they get to discuss and consider these options or to go through with any of these things is open and is accepting and is supportive, I am hoping to help alleviate some of the suffering for those people, as well as helping to alleviate some of the suffering for, or the suffering for the dog. But I think when it comes to behavioural euthanasia, for a lot of guardians, not all, for a lot of guardians who have gone through this and have made that awful decision, that there is a ton of shame associated with it. And one of the things that I see people comment on is that they just don't know how they're going to tell people that they've done this. And that tells me that there's trepidation there, that they're terrified of how that person will view them, terrified of what they'll say, terrified of what the wider world might think of them, particularly, you know, with social media. Everybody has such access to our day-to-day lives, right? So if we have like constant pictures of our dogs, and we know that social media is usually not a true representation of a person's life, like we talk about the Instagram life of a person, and that might be true of their dog as well. And then that suddenly there are no more photographs of that dog, or there are no more videos of that dog, or suddenly there's no more discussion of that dog. People are going to ask, where is, you know, the dog, what's happened to them. And I think people are really terrified, because they're, the inner life of us, you know, of each of us now is accessed by so many people, often people we don't know. maybe in real life.
It's crazy. Right? It's actually crazy.
It's really scary, isn't it? It's terrifying. And, you know, it is terrifying on so many levels. Yeah. But we still need you on Instagram to learn about our podcast. So see the other side of this.
It's a dark side to everything. Yeah, like, it's particularly dark, it's particularly social media. Right?
So, you know, I definitely feel that it's those outer forces that can absolutely make this harder. And that's why we have this little disclaimer at the beginning when we started to talk about this, because I want everybody who maybe has even thought about this or considered this to feel safe in doing so. But I also know that the world beyond that is not so accepting. And I will say, for the most of the people, so if we take the 17% of people that, or the, what was it, 23% of my cases last year, sorry, not 17, 23% of cases last year, you know, most of those people did really well in terms of surviving the aftermath. And I'm sure it's not over for them yet. I mean, we're only into February, and some of these dogs went, you know, towards the end of last year. So what I will say that I often find is that once we make the decision to do it and we plan the procedure, because that's one of the things that we do, we'll go through the entire planning of the procedure, as you would imagine for some of these dogs, particularly if they're fearful, that they would find, they would find the veterinary environment really difficult, the handling that's required. And also we plan the procedure so that the guardian knows what to expect. This is what happens. You know, they may have had no experience of euthanasia, or they may have maybe had experience before and it really wasn't very good, or they might have had experience of euthanasia as a child, and that can bring up a lot of kind of traumatic memories for them, because they may not have understood what was going on. And certainly euthanasia back in the day was quite a different experience for guardians. So guardians were kind of not considered to be really part of it. Animals were usually taken away. And all of these sorts of things. So, it's very different today. I know that almost all of the people who went with behavioural euthanasia for their dogs last year, with whom I worked with, almost all of them stayed with their dog right up to the end and went through all of that. So we had done a lot of planning and discussion in some of those cases about what to expect and how it goes and what's going to happen. And those are things, and that can sometimes provide them with a little bit of control. What I will find is that in almost all of those cases, while the people were very, very sad, obviously, and were grieving terribly, and all of them, not all of them, sorry, a lot of them will have said, you know what, I'm relieved we've done
it. Of course.
But then that feeling of relief is what contributes to guilt for a lot of them. So they initially might not experience the guilt, but then for some people they do. They experience the guilt initially. They're so profoundly hurt and hurting by that loss and the circumstances around the loss, which can sometimes be really layered. If the dog's behaviour has impacted the safety of loved ones, for example, and they have been left with fewer options because of that, the guilt then, if you know, making that choice, you know, well, I've chosen this loved one over this loved one. And I can absolutely understand it. And I don't have a cure for it. I will absolutely recommend there are some really good online pet loss resources that I will definitely recommend that people seek out. I also recommend that people seek compassionate counselling, whatever route that takes them down. So different people will have different preferences about what sort of care that would be therapeutic for them. And so I want that to be their decision. So I'm not going to say you need this sort of approach or this sort of approach or that sort of approach, because I think that's something that's so individual, right? Mm-hmm. And then there's a couple of really understanding places online, believe it or not. There's a Facebook group called Losing Lulu, which is specifically for people who have lost their dogs to behavioral euthanasia, and it's an incredibly safe and supportive environment.
Oh, wow, that's beautiful.
Where now, yeah, I think you do have to be careful though, there too, though. I will sometimes mute that group in my feed, because there are obviously going to be a lot of stories, people having various experiences with behavioral euthanasia, and some of them will be deeply upsetting. All of them are always sad, right?
Yeah,
because we're
talking
about the loss of a loved pet. So, you know, it doesn't really matter the circumstances, just pet loss is terribly sad and painful enough, regardless of the circumstances around it. So that can be definitely, that can be a place where, you know, sometimes just understanding that other people have gone through this experience and you're not alone and you're not the only one who's done this can be helpful. So that group, I'll often recommend that group to people who've experienced this as well. But I would absolutely encourage people to do that. I don't have an answer to say, how do you recover from the grief of losing a pet?
Because it's so individual.
And it's so hard. I mean, the experience is I think always harder than you think it's going to be, I think. You know, really, really difficult. But I think in this circumstance, you know, the one thing I want to do, and the reason that we're talking about this on this podcast, which is probably, it's probably a little bit beyond the scope, I would have said, maybe, but maybe not. But I want to open it in terms of there being acceptance for how we make these decisions, when we make them, why we make them, and that there are people behind these decisions, real human beings that have agonized over this. And, you know, I'm very, very quick to make sure that there is a space for us to have that discussion and to help provide information about this process. You know, hiding it behind closed doors makes it more shameful, almost by definition, right? So so we need to open those doors. We need to have the conversations. We need to make sure that people are safe to consider it if it's something that's going to work, even just to discuss it, so that we can see, no, look, there are loads of other things that we can do. We're not there yet. We're not at this point. And if we do get to that point, it's because we want to alleviate this dog's suffering.
Absolutely.
And, you know, and that's what we're doing. So I want you to recognize that that's what you're doing. So yes, you will still grieve. Yes, you will still miss them. Yes, you will still feel guilty for the coulda, woulda, shouldas. You know, not one of us can avoid that. But you can also understand that you are alleviating their suffering. And that's why we do this. It's the only reason we would do it. You know, it's not about, otherwise we would categorize it possibly as something else, but that's, that's not what this is about. So I don't have a magic wand for that one, but I would certainly suggest that you seek external support through the approach that works for you, to source some really good online and otherwise, I mean, those remote pet loss services can become in person as well. So there's, you know, there's a route there as well.
That's
I say, the Losing Lulu Facebook group is a good support as well, specifically in relation to behavioural euthanasia. They would be the things I would look at and recommend.
That's so cool. We were saying, how are we going to talk about this?
There you go. And then we're like, four and a half hours later.
Not quite.
Yeah.
But I think this will be, it stayed compassionate throughout. And
so important that we do that. And if there's anybody thinking about this, worrying about it, or just worried about your dog's behaviours of concern, please get in touch. Do it today. You know, leaving it another few months, leaving it another year, leaving to see what's going to happen, leaving it to experiment, is, you know, is not contributing to getting this better and to getting this back on track. You will not be judged. One of the things I spend a lot of time telling people is that there's no judgment here.
No.
Large tragedy because, you know, people in glass houses shouldn't throw stones.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
There's none of, not know. One of us perfect.
Exactly. You never know when you'll be in right. that situation yourself,
absolutely.
You know, or something similar.
Absolutely.
For sure.
And truth be told, I've had a dog where behavioural euthanasia was definitely a consideration. Mm. And I would not go through what I went through in terms of, with all the resources that I have, I would not go through that again.
Mm.
I wouldn't go through working through years of management and behaviour support stuff again. I wouldn't do that to myself again. I wouldn't do it to my dog again. Mm. And I am in awe of the people with whom I work, who will persevere
yeah.
and go to the ends of the earth to meet their dog's needs on a daily basis. I mean, they're absolute heroes. And at the same time, I am absolutely in awe of people who are strong enough to say, this isn't just about my welfare. I have to consider the welfare of this dog, and I am no longer able to provide for their needs, and I want to alleviate their suffering. So no, both sides of yeah. that client group, I am in awe of, and I feel so privileged to work with them, and I never judge them, ever, not once.
No,
and I think they're heroes, really, doing their absolute best. And I'm really sad when we have to have all these barriers around this discussion, because we have to keep, because, you know, people are so quick to judge and be judgmental and be hurtful and be shameful and things like that. And that's unacceptable to me.
I mean, just saying you like pineapple on pizza, you can be absolutely torn to shreds on the internet.
That's totally wrong. But that, I would agree with that. I would tear you to shreds for suggesting.
Come on.
That one we're allowed to shame you for because it's gross. Oh, yeah. Pineapple on pizza. What is wrong with you people?
I'm just hungry now. And it's nearly half 12.
Good night. Gross. No. Pineapple on pizza we're allowed to shame about. But behavioural euthanasia, no.
I just mean, like, it doesn't matter what. It could be anything. Like, the internet is set up to have us fighting.
It's about outrage, isn't it? It's about generating outrage.
Oh, my God.
So that's how the algorithm is designed. Anything that gets all of that really fast emotional responses. I mean, we literally call it clickbait. You know, so that's what it's designed to do. It's the most amazing. Social media is the most amazing, you know, clicker trainer of ever, right? Likes and loves and all of these things.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
It's a huge Skinner box that we're all in.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Basically.
Without any sort of benevolence looking out for us, and actually it wants us to be chaotic and to suffer. So, you know, so perhaps social media is not the place to have these discussions, but then I feel then we only leave the shame and judgment there. So it's very difficult to do. I don't ask anybody to be the pioneer and put themselves out there to be absolutely tortured. I wouldn't ask anybody to do that, particularly when experiencing grief. You know, you are not in a place to have to deal with that. But you know, there does have to be safe places where you can have those discussions. And we definitely want to open those up.
Yeah.
If we can.
Hey, that is a beautiful way to end this.
And I think I will just emphasise, because, you know, when we talk about alleviating suffering, when we talk about this in terms of physical conditions, we're saying that because we're at a point where we've run out of cures or we've run out of treatments. Mm. This is the difficulty with behaviour, and I think that's something that people don't understand. So in terms of helping you with your guilt, if this helps you with your guilt, then I'm happy about that, or it helps you with your consideration of this topic, in this compassionate way, is that behaviour isn't fixable or curable. A dog that's showing behaviours of concern isn't broken. They're not in need of fixing. Mm. And I think that's a really important thing. Yes, there are behaviours of concern that are pathological, as in they're, you know, related to disease. Absolutely, 100%. We're not arguing that. But the behaviours themselves are not fixable or curable. They're a product of the interaction of the body and the environment. Mm. So if we can't change the environment because the resources don't exist. That isn't something that we can deal with. So we don't turn off aggressive responding. We don't turn off fearful responding. It's not, we're not fixing something like a toaster or a car. It requires masses of investment in order to be able to do that, and while still maintaining the animal's quality of life. And I think that's where there's poor understanding. Of this is that, surely, you know, there's something that we can do to fix this dog. Well, there's nothing wrong with it. There's nothing broken about this dog. There's no such thing as bad behavior. The animal's behavior is just information telling us about their experiences. And so we have to have resources then to be able to modify the environmental conditions. And that's the limiting factor. So that's why behavioral euthanasia will sometimes, but rarely, it's not a common thing. It will rarely happen, but it does happen. And we need to be mindful of that. That's why that's happening.
Yeah, 100%. Thanks so much for talking for so long.
Oh, I know. And I'm
sorry. So in depth about it. No, I love it. It was always going to be one that we were just going to let us go for as long as it needed to go on for. Yeah, probably one that people might have to listen to a few times, and that's totally fine. But like as we said earlier, and always, just contact you guys.
Or you. Absolutely. We can direct you to the right place to get the support, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Don't leave it any longer. And you're not doing anything bad. Your dog isn't bad. You're not bad.
Definitely
don't listen to the,
it's quite the opposite.
The voices. There's nothing wrong with any of you.
No.
You're not broken.
No.
Really important to emphasize.
Yeah. Absolutely. All right. Well.
And no judgment. No judgment ever.
No. Well, thanks so much as always.
Thank you.
And we'll have more fun topics coming up soon.
Great. Yeah, it'll be funner than this, hopefully.
I know. It's a good idea. We have to talk about it. We can't just do all the fun stuff. Yeah.
No, it's important to talk about. No, I think it's a good, like, it's a good thing to talk about. I think we need to do that.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
And we'll be back to talk about, more cool stuff soon. Well, thanks so much.
And
look after yourself, as always.
Bye.
Thanks, Anne. Bye. Bye-bye. If you enjoy the show, remember to please subscribe to the podcast, leave a rating and review, and recommend it to your friends and family to help us reach and help more people and their dogs. Also, please give us a follow on Twitter at BarksidePod and also on Instagram at BarksidePod to help grow our online community. Look after yourselves and your doggies. Thanks again for joining us, and we look forward to seeing you here again real soon.